This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At chumbacasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions 18+.
Hello and welcome to this episode of Mattophile, where I had the pleasure of talking with the analyst, academic and translator, Mr. Shintaro Hara, on the insurgency in the deep south of Thailand. The deep south of Thailand, or the Thai border with Malaysia, is something I've been wanting to talk about ever since I did the episodes on the history and politics of Thailand. It's an insurgency that gets much less coverage than it's actually due, because there is a population of disenfranchised Malay Muslims who occupy the area that is currently under political Thailand. It's an area that's been long neglected, and our conversation talks about why developmental strategies implemented by an unstable government in Thailand are oftentimes incredibly ineffective at addressing people's grievances from the region itself. The Pattani region is one of the poorest regions in Thailand, and we talk about the kinds of reform that are necessary to help the region recover, its cultural practices be acknowledged at a national level, and why the right to self-determination is incredibly important to most people in the area. Further, we talk on why liberation movements such as the BRN are oftentimes ineffective conduits for addressing and are quite ineffective even as proxies for general grievances expressed by most people in the Pattani region. I also should preemptively apologize because the sound quality in certain segments of this interview is quite bad owing to poor internet connectivity on my end. Here's my conversation with Mr. Hara. Hello and welcome to this episode of Mattophile, where today I have the pleasure of being joined by Mr. Shintaro Hara, who is a scholar and a translator who's living in the Pattani region of Thailand today and works on the Deep South insurgency in Thailand. Thank you so much for joining us today, sir.
You're welcome. And nice to see you.
I think the place I want to start with is the history of the insurgency. So who are the Pattani Malay Muslims? What is their historic background? And why is there an insurgency in the deep south of Thailand today?
Okay, it's a very big question. So you know, let me start from the kind of historical background here. This region, or southernmost part of Thailand, used to have a Malay kingdom. And the status of it is not very clear whether or not this was an independent sovereign country or not. Because this country, of course, has their own ruler, which is called Raja, right? But at the same time, they also sent a tribune to the Ayutthaya kingdom. So this is why the Thailand or the Siam kingdom claimed that this region has been their own land. But for Malays, this is something unacceptable, because they regard this kingdom as an independent kingdom and invaded by Siamese and finally annexed and also colonized by them. So as a background, there are two different way of seeing this region. From Thai point of view, this has been a part of Thailand from the long past. But for Malays, this is their own land, which used to be an independent kingdom, which it was annexed and also colonized without any consent from the local people. So this is, so to say, a kind of a historical background. And then this part of the world was invaded by Siamese in 1785, more than 200 years ago. And then since then, it was almost officially under the control of Thai. But at that time, this region still kept some kind of a high level of autonomy. So even the rulers must be acknowledged by Thai, but they still have their own regional ruler. But after the Bangkok Treaty, 1909, the borders between these two countries are demarcated. And since then, this part has been officially annexed into Thailand, or Kingdom of Siam at that time. From the local Malay Muslims' point of view, this arrangement was done between two colonizers. One is a Thai, and the other one is a British, right? So to say, the starting point of the Thai governance in this region is conducted without any assent from the local people. So this is why the viewpoint to see this part of Thailand as a colonized region still remains to this day. So this is a kind of a ideological background. So after this part of land was formally annexed into Thailand in the early 20th century, the local people continued to struggle to fight against the Thai dominance or Thai governance, and they demanded a high autonomy. Their struggle had been unsuccessful, and in some occasions almost brutally suppressed. Especially, there is one important figure who is called Haji Sulong. He was a religious leader in this region, and also politically participated in the movement of the people. So he submitted what is called as a seven demands for high autonomy. And since then, what happened to him was that he was charged and he was imprisoned, and after release, he was abducted. This happened in 1954. So he disappeared since then. And then this could be one of the reasons that drove the struggle of the Patani people into the underground. And another thing is that, so since then, in the 1960s, the armed group began to be formed. So there are several groups which still remain to this day, like BRN, Barisan Revolusi Nasional, or National Revolutionary Front, or PULO, Patani United Liberation Organization, and also BIPP, Barisan Islam Pondebasan Nasional, Patani Islamic Liberation Front, and so on. All of them are formed in this era, in the 1960s. And what is more important is that some of the those founding fathers of this organization used to be member of parliament in this region. For instance, one of the founding fathers of BRN is called Haji Amin. Haji Amin is a son of Haji Sulong, that disappeared, forcibly disappeared with the Muslim leaders in this region. And he ran for the election and he won almost landslide victory. And then he became an MP from this region. And he tried to broke the issue of this region, which had been quite unsuccessful. And he was so disappointed, and he was, so to say, threatened by the authority. And finally, he ran to Malaysia and become one of the founding members of the BRN. And another example is another man who was son of the last Raja of the Saiburi district. And he also ran for the MP, and also he won from Narathiwa province. So one or two times, I think, he won the election. And he tried to bring the issue more actively to the central government. And he sent letters to the prime minister, then prime minister of Thailand, and so on. And in order to bring the issue of the South to the central government, which was never been, so to say, properly dealt with. And this disappointment also drove him to Malaysia. And he also established his own organization, which still exists to this day. So these are the historical background that first, Patani people tried to fight against the state by using the democratic method or political method. But all their struggle came into a blind alley, or there was no way out, which drove many local leaders, religious leaders, intellectuals, and so on, drove all those people to Malaysia. They formed their own front or their own organization in order to fight against the Thai state. And then it was also the starting point of the armed struggle, which still continues to this day.
So you mentioned that this was the start of the armed struggle of the Patani Malay Muslims. My question then is, if all these leaders fled to Malaysia, did the Malaysian government or the Malaysian parliament actively try persuading Thailand to allow this region more political power or to secede to Malaysia or to form its own independent region?
This is a very delicate matter. And Malaysia also has a kind of ambivalence which they have to face. So first, it has to keep a good relationship with Thailand, especially as a member of the ASEAN. And also, in the past, these two countries cooperate together in order to suppress the communists, which crosses the border quite freely, right? But at the same time, it is also difficult or even almost very sensitive for the Malaysian government to push them back to Thailand, so to say, to arrest them, because in Malaysia, there are quite a few people whose ancestors are from Patani, especially in the states like Kelantan, Perak, Kedah, and so on. In these states, there are quite a few people whose ancestors are from Patani region. Although the Malaysian government has never been supporting these activities in a very blatant, you know, so to say, blatant, very overt way, but at the same time, they allow them over turning blind eyes for these people staying here as long as they do not break the Malaysian rule. So for instance, if they try to make some connection with the Jamia Islamia or ISIS or some groups which are regarded as a global terrorist, and then at that time I'm sure that they will be ruined or they will have no chance anymore in Malaysia. Right? So both sides have to be very careful in order to keep, so to say, status quo of the circumstances. So for me, it's still impossible for Malaysia to suppress these people. But at the same time, for the insurgent, also for the insurgent, it's also very difficult for them to actively operate in this region without violating the Malaysian law.
The question then is, when did this struggle become armed? So you said that up until, say, the 1960s and the 1970s, the struggle was largely not an armed struggle. People were trying to access legitimate means of venting their grievances to the Thai government. What drove these parties to then take up armed struggle and an armed conflict and then be termed an insurgency?
Okay, so in this case, actually, the armed struggle began in the 1960s, right? But at the same time, there are some struggles on the ground as well. It doesn't mean that all the struggle suddenly coming to the underground. So some parts of the struggle going to the underground, and they staged some armed struggle. But at the same time, there are a struggle on the surface as well, like the example of the very big demonstration, which has been hugely neglected in the Thai history. But there was a very big demonstration in 1975 in Patani. And at some peaks, it was joined by hundreds of thousands of people. And this is a very huge number, because the entire population of Patani at that time is probably more than just about 1 million. So this was a really huge political movement. And this kind of movement continued almost to this day. So for instance, you know, I think it was yesterday, there was a demonstration against the military government in Lela province, which was organized by the youth. So this, even if there is a military struggle, it doesn't mean that the struggle on the surface will stop. So they also try to, Patani people, so to say, try to struggle or try to channel the problem by using several ways. So in my understanding, the armed struggle or underground struggle is just one of the ways. And also it could be the main way, but as well, at the same time, we cannot discard the existence of these legal or democratic struggle on the surface.
So in the Patani provinces today, do they still have a seat in parliament, or are they not represented in the political sphere at all today? Is there still an elected seat given to these Patani districts,
or not?
Yeah. So it's depending on the how the central government can open to them. And in the past, there was a very huge group called Wadah Group, which is a group of local Muslim Malay politicians, which is quite influential. And then after that, at one time, they become very weak and replaced by some other political parties. And then now they resurfaced again in the name of another party, which is called the Pacha Chat Party. So in this case, this also depending on the extent of democracy in Thailand as well. So as you know, Thailand has so many coup d'etats, right? And the constitutions are often discarded, and also the parliament is also disbanded and so on. So we just had the latest election in 2018. So it was just very new. Before that, almost 3 to 4 years, I think, we had no election whatsoever. And when this kind of political space opens up, the Pattani Malays, especially people from Pattani, this region has 3 provinces, right? Pattani, Lanna, and Ratiwad. And people from all these provinces are ready to seize the political opportunities in order to send their representatives in the parliament.
What does the 2019 election then mean for the province, for these 3 provinces? What is Prayut Chan-o-Cha want with the people in these provinces? How does he plan on dealing with the insurgency in the Deep South?
In terms of the election, there was a kind of a split result. So some constitutions are won by pro-government or pro-junta candidates, but I think it's more than half of the constitutions are won by the officials. But in terms of what the current prime minister wants to do with this region is very significant, in the sense that he has changed the name of the peace process. The change happened in the name of in the Thai name. It used to be called the peace process. So in Thai, it is called the Krabongkan Santipa. So here, the word Santipa means the peace, literally peace. And then he changed this word Santipa into Santisu, which means domestic happiness, you see. So it is quite clear for the current government to regard this as a totally internal problem. And if possible, they want to solve this problem without any interference from the foreign actors.
And how do the multiple groups in the region feel about this change in rhetoric from the government? Because presumably there are small guerrilla groups that are leading an armed and a violent struggle. And then there's larger groups that are non-violent in nature as well. So how do different groups feel about this change of rhetoric from Prayut's government?
In this case, I mean, I would like to stress that at this moment, of course, there are several groups, but at the same time, there are some misunderstandings here. So for instance, the term which may, if you read something written on this region, you may bump into the term RKK, right? So RKK is not an organization. This is the smallest military cell of BRN. And BRN itself has a political section as well as a military section. So I wouldn't say they are kind of a monolithic, but at the same time, it's quite wrong to see that this as a kind of a disorganized fraction. But in actuality, in my opinion, it's quite organized. And recently, it has been proved after the outbreak of COVID-19, the BRN from one YouTube clip announced one unilateral ceasefire. And this has been effective almost to this day, all over the conflict area, almost completely. Of course, there are some skirmishes and also some retaliations. It's not completely stopped. But in comparison to the previous time, the effect of the ceasefire announcement has been almost tremendous. It's almost incredible. So this, in my opinion, indicates that this is not done by the fraction of the small groups. Some people say that this is a network of the small groups, and also the effectiveness of the announced ceasefire is one of the clear evidence to indicate that these armed groups also working under the strong coordination of a big organization. I could be wrong because they are basically underground organization. This is my understanding.
Okay, and if that is true, then surely the peace process becomes easier because you have a large political faction of the BRN with which the Thai government would probably be holding peace talks with.
has the creation of a political entity or a large body that has organized Pathani grievances in the South made the peace process easier or made it more difficult?
Okay, so as you said, if really BRN can be political representatives of the Pathani people, it must be very easy for them to voice up the issues. And also the peace process must go very smoothly, right? But the problem is that kind of BRN is a kind of a organization which is using a remote control in Malaysia. So it's not like an organization which has their own territory and the people on the ground, and also they can struggle on their own ground. But in case of Pathani, the difficulty is that most of the leaders live abroad. Most of them in Malaysia, and some of them might be in Sweden or maybe some other countries. We have no idea. But surely they are not in Thailand. So this is another problem. To what extent they can be a political representative of the local people? And this is a kind of a challenge also for the BRN in order to consolidate this aspect. In my opinion, so far, BRN has been successful, or at least they have been effective in the military struggle since 2004, when the recent wave of the violence erupted. But on the other hand, since that time to this day, the political struggle has been very slow or very ineffective. So for this reason, I wanted to find, so to say, sustainable solution for this conflict. I suppose and I believe that the political, so to say, political empowerment of the BRN is a kind of a necessary condition.
I want to move slightly more towards the actual region and what is going on ground in the Pathani region, because you, of course, live in the Pathani region, and you mentioned that there is a disconnect between the people on ground and the people in Malaysia that hold power.
Yes.
On ground, What is the economic situation of the Pathani region like today? Is it economically much worse off than other regions in Thailand? If so, Why is this impoverishment there, and what is being done to solve it?
It's a very difficult question, because it could be answered in many ways. So first, we cannot dismiss the impact of the COVID, right? So of course, you know, it's not only here, but all over the country, all over the world, I would say. The economic situation has been quite bad. But at the same time, I also conducted some interviews from the civil society members and also the local merchant and so on. And most of them agree that the impact on this region is not as big as other parts of the country, except certain regions which has been largely dependent on the border trades, like, you know, the border cities with Malaysia and heavily affected. But if you come into this region, especially Pathani province, which doesn't border with Malaysia, you can see that actually economic is, and I cannot present you the actual figure, but many people have a feeling that the economic activity has been more active. And many people try to seize the opportunity for waging on something new. So here, ironically, after the COVID, almost all other parts of the country has been affected. But in this region, it has a counter effect, so to say, something different happened. Because after the ceasefire, many people mentioned that regional tourism has been developing. So there are many places which had been inaccessible, now become accessible. And people are ready to go there, going for camping, doing things and buying things, and, you know, and so on. Mainly these areas located in the forest or in mountainous regions and so on, remote areas, where people used to fear to access because they are afraid of the violent incidents. But because of the ceasefire, now people can, so to say, make a good plan. And they are there to go certain places which they used to be afraid of. So there are kind of a, of course, you know, I wouldn't deny that, you know, this is affected by the COVID and those are some other things. And also, in general, this region has a very low income as well. But at the same time, I wouldn't say this is because of COVID, but there's a kind of a positive impact from that as well. But in general picture, this region has been regarded as one of the poorest regions in the region. Poorest region in the country. And the government tried to So puts a large amount of budget for the, so to say, development, but the development is not something, some development has been brought about in the way, which is not necessarily in accordance with the local, what the local people want. So recently the government is trying to open up an industrial area in the Chana district from the Songkhla province, which is still part of the conflict region. And they try to oust, you know, to chase away the local people and open up a huge industrial area. And there, now there are people who are supportive, who can, you know, get some benefits from the, this project. But according to my observation, most of the local people are against that because they are going to lose. So this is an example that it's always, it's even the development brought by the government can be the reasons of the conflict as well. So this is a, in this aspect, the government has not, hasn't been careful enough in order to deal with this sensitive issue.
This is all new news to me because I haven't read about any of this online, because I read that the government is trying to provide development aid to Patani regions and regions in the south, but that aid is not being effective. And I think you explained it really well as to why that aid is not being effective and why those funds are not actually helping local populations on ground. I think the second question out of this then is, if this is one of the poorest regions in Thailand, how are the insurgency groups like the BRN actually getting money? Where do they get the money from? How do they generate funds for their activities?
Okay, so this is a very good question. And also this has been a big mystery for them, mystery for the researchers as well. So in the past, we know that they gathered one baht per day from the members. But as far as I guess, it's been published. So at this moment, I have no idea how they try to raise money for the struggle. But at the same time, I also have to agree with the very fact that their struggle is a very kind of economic. So they have never used, so to say, military vehicles, and also they do not have the regular army. Or even if they have a regular army, the number is very extremely small, right? Unlike in the past. So now their strategy seems like they try to sustain their own struggle, but in a low-cost way, as low as possible. So this is my understanding. But at the same time, where the money comes from is another good question. And also in this aspect, I suppose that one of the sources must be the money they can earn from Malaysia. And also there could be some money collection from in the region. So and also for your information, in this region, although the GDP itself is very low, but hundreds of thousands of people going to Malaysia in order to work in restaurants. So the accurate number is not known because quite a few of them go to Malaysia quite legally, actually, and only some portion of them are registered as a migrant labor. And most of them are kind, so to say, legal laborers. And they also generate some amount of money, which is not documented in any kind of the economic statistics in Thailand. So there are some kind of unknown parts in terms of the economy in this region. And also there are some people say that they get money from the illegal businesses or the drug dealings. But as far as I know, this is highly unlikely. I wouldn't deny the very fact that some members are involved in this kind of illegal business, but it's not them in the organization way. Because basically you have to know the local influential people who are local mafias in order to conduct these. And in some cases, like in some border areas, illegal petrol imported smuggled from Malaysia are openly sold. So if this is the money, you know, the financial resource for the insurgent, it's impossible for them to sell in this way. Only no, I'm very sorry that I cannot answer your question directly because I'm afraid that no one can answer in a very precise way, except who are in charge of the financial affair of these insurgents. But what I might say is that they still try to keep their struggle as, you know, so to say, not costly, as cheap as possible. And for this reason, they expanded their own kind of a regular army, which they used to have in the 80s and 90s. But they, at this moment, I'm quite sure the number is very, very big. And now they use the strategies of the terrorism or by using violence in the cities and also in the roadside rather than encountering the forests while the mountains regions.
That's interesting. And I'm glad you mentioned the drug trade and the implication that people think that they might be involved in illegal activities and illegal smuggling. Because from what I've read, even the government, the previous government before Prayuth, thought that the Deep South was responsible for a lot of illegal trade and a lot of illegal drug trafficking across the border. How has the Thai government's war on drugs affected Pathani populations? And has the military presence increased since the war on drugs? And has that made it harder to achieve peace in the region?
In my observation, the drug problems and also insurgency is a totally different matter, which is, has some kind of connection, but it's basically it's a different sources, different reason, and also for different actors. So in this aspect, of course, you know, in this region, there are so many smuggling. This is very true. For instance, smuggling the petrol from Malaysia and also smuggling the cigarettes from Indonesia, because in this region, the Indonesian cigarette is very popular. But at the same time, it's also interesting that in this region, there are hardly any human trafficking, unlike the opposite side of the border. So this is the east coast of Thailand, right? Whereas the most of the human trafficking, like the Rohingyas and so on, happened in the west side. So this is another indicator, the indication that who are involved in this kind of human trafficking. I wouldn't say who, I wouldn't point out who it is. But in the area where the state control cannot fully reach, there has been very small, or hardly any human trafficking. But illegal business are conducted in some other things, like goods, rice, cigarettes, petrol, and so forth.
Okay. And I want to shift slightly away from this and talk a bit about the relationship of the people of this region and the military of Thailand. Because obviously the military is a big player in the peace process of the Deep South and the Deep South insurgency. What are the military's attitudes towards Malay Muslim people in the South? Are they generally aggressive or do they want to try talking out to a peaceful resolution?
So I must say the relationship between the state authority or state security force with the local people has never been good. If you look at any book written by the close observers, you will never find anything except government propaganda, which says we have established kind of rapport or good relationship with each other. But in fact, it has never been good. So I wouldn't, it is in the past, it's not the army, but it was rather like the police of police, which was been feared by the local people. And recently it changed into the military, right? But basically these, the local people see them as the security forces. So it's basically there's no difference because they are for the security and also from the state, right? So in the past it was mainly the police. The reason is very simple because especially since the 2004, the situation has been even worse, in my opinion, because they are now using two special laws. One is called the martial law, and second is called the emergency decree. Emergency decree has become quite popular for those who are closely observing Thailand, because the central government is now using this decree in order to control the situation, or to put it very frankly, to control or to to deter the student demonstrations. But in the South, these two laws have been used for more than 15 years, almost from the beginning of the insurgency in 2004. And the problem is that under this, so to say, draconian special laws, the security forces can detain anybody without any warrant for 7 days. Actually, this is according to the martial law, right? And detention can be done anywhere for 7 days. And this can be extended by the emergency decree for another 3 days. So put it very simply, local people, totally innocent people it could be, can be arrested only because they are a suspect for 37 days without any warrant. Actually, for the emergency decree, a warrant is needed, but the usual procedure is somebody is arrested or detained based on emergency, martial law, and detained for 7 days. And during these 7 days, the authority prepare the arrest warrant for this guy in order to extend his detention based on the emergency decree. And until this day, allegations of torture has never been stopped. And if you worked with human rights lawyers or human rights organizations in this region, there is nobody who can deny the existence of torture done by the military forces. And also there are several, as far as I know, unnatural deaths which happened during the detention. So for this reason, I think it's quite natural for the local people to regard the security force of the state rather as a threat rather than their protector or the guardian.
Okay, that's really worrying. Now my question is to do with what do the Patani people actually want? Like, there is clearly unrest. They clearly do not like the way the Thai state has been treating them. What do they want? Mm-hmm. Do they just want simple recognition? So do they want the Patani language to be recognized in Thailand and more political inclusion? Or do they want a separate state and some degree of autonomy for that region?
So this could be vary from one person to another. So for the most extreme guys, Patani must be independent. But for some people are very happy with the Thai state. And also because they are part of this state and they can be rich, they can be powerful, and they can be anything. So some people don't want to have any change. But in general, I might say, not many people are very happy with the current situation, just like in the other part of the Thailand, that they need some kind of justice. So in my opinion, this could be wrapped into just one or two words. It could be right to self-determination. So right to self-determination could be just having an elected mayor or partial autonomy or high autonomy or even independence, right? So it's on the line of the self-determination, but the degree of what they want could be different, right? So some people just want, some people can accept nothing but independence, but for some people, high autonomy is good enough. For some people, just decentralization or devolution, or even just the status quo. So it could be different. But the recognition of the, so to say, the identity is part of that. So in my opinion, recognition of the first is that in Thailand, in the identification card, the nationality is Thai and ethnicity for everybody is Thai, which is, in my opinion, this is not academic. Academically speaking, this is unacceptable because this Thailand has lots of ethnicity, right? Like Chinese and also Hui tribes and Malays and so on. For instance, I get married with a Malay Muslim here, and she is Malay, and I'm Japanese, and my children, on their birth certificate, the ethnicity is Thai. It's impossible. My sons, my children has no Thai blood, actually. It's Malay and Japanese, right? In this case, the state itself is too nationalistic to allow, so to say, genuine diversity. And this kind of stiffness might drive some people become more, so to say, radical. So in this case, in my opinion, the Thai government should be more open to the diversity and also the recognition and so on. Otherwise, my concern is that this stiff policy might push more people to the extent of the independence or high autonomy or anything like this, rather than they are capable of doing any kind of reconciliation or compromise. So under the current situation, it's really highly risky, and also, in my opinion, it's quite unclever for the Thai state to using the iron fist approach. So at least it's compared to 10 years or maybe 15 years ago, the situation has been improving because now at least, even there has been almost no progress, but we still have the flame of the peace talk, right? And in my opinion, the Thai government shouldn't discard this fragile flame. They have to keep at whatever the cost is. And also, they have to concentrate on this and also make some kind of a significant improvement of the situation by using this claim. Otherwise, I'm afraid that the local people might be more radicalized than now.
So correct me if I'm wrong, but mm-hmm. from the sounds of this, it sounds like the Thai government since the 1960s and 70s has been pushing a policy of Thaification, which is unifying Thailand under ethnicity and religious terms. And mm-hmm. that has systemically denied people in the south of Thailand an access to their own independent ethnicity or their own independent identity as a separate people. And that is making yeah. people increasingly angry. But yeah. this problem hasn't been a new problem. It's been a problem for the past 50 or 60 years. Why has no international human rights organization noticed this or done anything about this? What is the role of organizations such as the UN Human Rights Watch in helping solve this problem in the Deep South?
That's a very good question. And also, this is a kind of a, I cannot say this is a positive thing, but at least this is something we get after this area is covered by the media and also attract international attention. Otherwise, this region could be swallowed by the typhification or siamization or assimilation whatsoever. And after the there has been so many violent incidents, so at first it's more like people are interested in the cessation of the violence, but now people begin to observe more closely and more, so to say, more in the overall picture to see the problem, and they begin to notice that it actually has something to do with the old stories. And as I said before, this incidents or this human rights problems doesn't happen just in 10 or 15 years ago, but it has been like this for a very long time. And basically, this the issue or the problems of this region has never been fully solved by the state side. Of course, compared to the past, there are some improvements, but there are still so many things which must be done.
And in your opinion, then, what is the future for this deep south of Thailand? Do you think that there is a peaceful resolution that is going to come soon because of the current ceasefire? Or do you think the conflict is going to stretch out over another 10 or 20 years? What do you think is going to happen now?
It could be in both way, or it could be a different way as well. So this, in terms of the future, there is no. It's very difficult. It's, in my opinion, the prediction of the this region is far more difficult than the predicting the weather of the 10 years later. So everything can happen. But in my opinion, the Thai state at least begin to learn something. So they are not as harsh as before. And also the Thai state, so to say, I wouldn't say they're good, but at least so to say, more lenient compared to some other governments in this region. So they are still capable of talking with insurgents, still capable of adapting their policies and so on. So for instance, in the past, they are careless enough to meddle with the Islamic things or religious issues. And then the people could unite together, fight against the anti-Islamic government. And at that time, the Thai government was anti-Islamic. But at this moment, I must say, Thai government has not been hostile to the religion itself. So this is a kind of government which is capable of changing, right? And also, depending on the to what extent, so even this region is a very unique, but at the same time, this is a part of Thailand. So if you look at the history of this region, you can see clear link between what's going on in the center and also what's going on in this region as well. So for instance, if the Thailand become more nationalistic, more military oriented, and more like, so to say, more like Burma or Myanmar, and then in that case, the conflict will never stop. But if the Thailand genuinely can become a democratic and respect human rights and acknowledgement of diversity and so on, in that case, the conditions which enables the conflict itself also can be reduced or even can be solved. So it's depending on so many things. But the one of the main factors is what Thai government could be in the future. So in my opinion, the future condition hugely depending on this as well. And also the Malay people as well. But mainly this is still part of the highly centralized country called Thailand. So I'm sure that any solution, any feasible solution cannot happen per se in this region. But it has something very strong connection with what's going on in the center.
And how important is a stable central government in helping resolve this conflict? Because the Thai government, as you've also mentioned, has been overthrown several times by several different coup d'etats, and there are protests going on currently as well. How important is a stable center to coming towards a solution in the south?
Yeah. So in this aspect, I mean, we have to be careful on two points. One is that the central government should be stable, and also, in my opinion, should be democratic. Right, so it's we need a very strong or stable democratic government which is not meddled by the interference of the military or some other extra judicial things. Right, this is the first thing. But at the same time, the power is too centralized in Bangkok. It's amazing. Even Thailand is centralized in almost everything, not only power, but also wealth, population, and so on. Everything is in Bangkok, right? So it's depending on two things. First is a strong government, strong democratic government, or so to say, stable government. But at the same time, this government should also be serious in terms of the decentralization. So they have to give up something given to the region. For instance, the decision-making or the governance power, including the budgets as well. Now, almost 70% of the entire budget is spent in Bangkok compared to the other region. So it's ridiculous. So in my opinion, this is another crucial issue for the solution of the conflict, which has been killed more than 7,000 people in the last 16 years.
And just lastly, before I let you go, are there any media sources like books or news media sources that you can recommend to our listeners to help better understand the insurgency in the Deep South in Thailand and the conflict of the Deep South?
Unfortunately, in English, the source is very limited, but maybe you can follow certain websites like Pracha Thai, the news agency called Bunar News, or Thai English papers like especially the Bangkok Post and so on. Although the coverage is not very wide enough or deep enough, but at least you can follow. And also, if you are interested in this region, what I can recommend is that try to search from the net and also some other things. You can find quite a few articles which you can read free about this region. Actually, this region is a very interesting region. So, many things are written in three languages, in English, in Bahasa Melayu, Malay, and also in Thai. So in my opinion, this is a very highly overstudied region. So it's quite interesting, and you can find very different sources. But in terms of the current development, it's still quite difficult. But try to follow these, especially Bunar News, and also if you read Thai, Isara News Agency is another selection. But I'm very sorry to acknowledge that at this moment, the information gateway is still quite limited.
Thank you so much for joining us today, Shintaro. It's been incredible having you, and I've loved learning more about the Deep South insurgency, and hopefully for the people on ground, development and a peaceful solution will come soon as a result of this ceasefire. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
On another unrelated note, a friend of mine is working with this organization called Standpoint India. The organization is trying to build fora for better discourse on politics, economics, social justice, and society. And they're running a course on public diplomacy and soft power along with the India Foundation. Deadline for registration of this course is the 11th of November, and I encourage all of you to check it out because it looks rather interesting and might be a good start if you want to enter fields such as diplomacy and international relations. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Matterfile, and I hope to see you next time. This has been about the Deep South in Thailand.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of the Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play the Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.